Thank you to the Pollock, correct?
Yes,
thank you to Leonard and Shoshana Pollock for sponsoring today's shir in memory of Shoshana's mother, Leah Esther Bas Avram. Today's Yahrzeit.
Yes.
Okay, very nice. I know I gave it Kamala. I just didn't know when the Yahrzeit was. I guess it was today. Very nice. Emrit Hashem, our learning should be Le'ilu Nishmasa. Does she have any deep American roots?
I'll tell you a funny story.
Yes.
Ellie Bear, who just recently had his seventh, I said, "Oh, Ellie," I said, "that your kid's a fifth generation Ohio." And he said, "What are you talking?" I said, "Ellie," I said, he goes, "I think of myself as a true Detroiter." I said, "You were born in Ohio. Mother was born in your Ohio. This kid was born in Ohio, and so was my mother's mother was also born in Ohio. So yes, she actually." In Ravenna.
Wowee.
So actually, she's the oldest Ohioan.
Wowee. Okay, so deep American roots.
None of them on the Confederate side.
None of them on the Confederate side. Okay.
But that Ellie's kid is fifth generation Ohio, whether he likes it or not.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
I'm
going
to have to put you on Zoom because I don't know how to listen.
You're in the splash zone now. Okay, let's get started here. Thank you again to the Pollocks. And apparently a fifth generation Ohio family. My grandmother's family is also from Ohio. She was she's back there somewhere. Akron, though. I don't know if you guys are from Akron. Okay, welcome Danny, welcome Steve, Evan, everyone got their coffee, that's good. Let's talk a little bit about Charleston, South Carolina. I wish I could talk more about it. We're going to talk, but I have a colleague who's right now a rabbi in Charleston, South Carolina. I tried to get in touch with him. I might have the wrong phone number because he won't respond to me, but I might have some other add-ons to the shir after we're done. If I ever do get in touch with him. But the community of South Carolina is probably one of the oldest Jewish communities in America. And they say that they weren't the first settlers, 1654, but I believe it was early 1729, I think I saw, that South Carolina first had Jews in it. And they quickly became one of the mainstays of Jewish communities in America. Like, we think nowadays, like, New York City. So that was Charleston, South Carolina back then. But when we think of New York City, we think of, like, 100,000 Jews, whatever it is, maybe a million Jews. I don't know however many it is. But back then, Charleston, South Carolina, right, the Jewish city was, like, you know, 500 Jewish families. We're not talking about, like, huge, huge numbers, but we are talking about, like, Jews in America. We're talking Charleston, South Carolina. And we don't know much about sort of the Orthodox Jewish community there until really either the late 18th century or the early 19th century. And they basically, they start their shul early on in the 1800s. It's a place called Beth Elohim. That's what the name of the shul is. And it's an interesting place because it's Sephardic. If you have to remember that America at the time was in some ways, even though it's, you know, 100, 200 years later, it's heavily influenced or settled by people from Spain and the expulsion of that kind. So people would go, they came, I think, from the south originally, if I'm not mistaken, like south, like Mexico and the Caribbeans, and they would make their way up into America. And they're still like that traveling families from the Spanish expulsion. This is my understanding of it. So when they settle in Charleston, South Carolina, and this is important for the history of South Carolina, they essentially create a Sephardic community. It's Spanish Portuguese, if you remember the name from the shul in New York City. So it's in many ways that kind of rite, R-I-T-E. And that's going to be important because there's going to be an Ashkenazic breakoff, and during the Civil War, they're going to act differently, which is very relevant for what we're talking about here. I came on... What did I say?
Their own civil war.
Their own civil war. Yeah, yeah. Civil war within a civil war. Well, it doesn't seem to be so, as contentious. Doesn't look like. But there is definitely a big difference between them. I came onto this topic because I was looking into the Civil War, being Memorial Day. Thought we would talk something about, you know, Jewish, infantry or whatever. And there wasn't much in terms of a halachic discussion around it. You know, nowadays in Israel, in the Israeli army, so there's a lot of halacha, there's a lot of tshuvas that go into how do you fight a war, what types of things can you do, what things can't you do. But there's not much of that. And I maybe there is some and I didn't see it. There's not a lot of information about that I could find about responses of Jews in wartime. There are, however, interesting stories. So there's a story about Pesach and getting matzah into the army. There, I saw there was a story about people trying to get, you know, an absence, right, to you know, asking to leave for this holiday, for that holiday, and then perhaps the biggest I guess episode happens because of the Civil War, and that is allowing Jewish chaplaincy. That was apparently a thing, or actual law. Like, we think of America today, you know, the separation of church and state, we think of it as like a given. Like, you want to be religious in America, you can do whatever you want. Obviously, there are some sticky issues, public school prayer, stuff like that, that always sort of, you know, blur the boundaries about what does free mean and what is, you know, blue laws. Okay, blue laws is another interesting example of that. All right, Steve is switching over. He's switching over to the other side. But back then, you have to remember that America was founded well, first of all, some of these laws are pre-Declaration of Independence, right? Pre-Constitution. But even after the Constitution, there were laws on the books, especially state by state, that precluded non-Christians from serving in official capacities. There were Congress people that weren't allowed to be voted in. There was a lot of controversy in terms of Jewish people taking office and swearing on the Bible. And the army was no different. The chaplaincy was restricted to Christians only. I believe only Christians. There was this whole debate. There was one chaplain that tried to get in and was refused. And then another one, I think his name was Arnold Fischer, Arnold Fischel was the first Jewish chaplain in the American army, I believe, for the Union. But the interesting part is the South, or the Confederacy, was in many ways more, well, this is controversial, but was more accommodating to Jewish chaplains than the North was. Right, because you think of, I don't know exactly, I don't know the history well enough. Again, disclaimer, I'm not an expert in any of this. But it seems that the South was more of like go with the flow type than it was, you know, in the official states of the Union, right? So while there were rules and regulations in the North, the Confederate Army was more like go with the flow, we'll take anybody who wants to fight with us type. I'm not really exactly sure, how accurate that presentation is, but there was a book written, I think, in the early 2000s called The Jews and the Confederacy, something like that. And it was a very controversial book in the Jewish community because what it did was it highlighted Jewish participation in the Confederate Army. And the way it presented it was that the Jews were, in many ways, simply just being patriotic. They were being part of the part of the call. Part of the cause for their neighbors and things like that. And while there was anti-Semitism, there was also this reactionary movement from the Jews to prove their worth, right? So it was sort of like this tension, and some of the controversy from that book talks about, you know, the same thing that you would talk about in general about the Confederate Army in terms of what are they fighting for? Are they fighting for slavery? Are they fighting for their own rights? Or the whole, you know, there's a thing called the Lost Cause. Is it a real thing or is it not a real thing? But this book brought certain sympathies to the Confederacy that people don't like. You know, they see it as apologetics or they see it as, even worse than that. So So that's the sort of the backdrop of some Jewish, you know, obviously I'm speaking generalities because I don't know specifics, but that's some of the backdrop in terms of the Jewish relationship with the Confederacy in the South. But when we think of rabbinic responses or guidance to the Civil War, so we talked about that a few classes ago in terms of different rabbinic lectures, different rabbinic statements that were brought out this side and that side. Some of them were more accommodating, some of them were less accommodating, some of them were attributed to be more racist than they really were, if you remember. Yeah, Jason?
Do you think it's fair to look at these people by our standards today rather
right.
than by the standards yes. of 1865?
Yeah, so that's one of the big, or 1861, which is really when it, yeah. But, that's really one of the big questions that goes into this discussion, this person's book, which is to what extent were the Jewish people just trying to be like everybody else? And to what extent were they morally evil people, right? So we look at it today, like, how could you ever think that? But back then, there are things that we do today. You know, I'm not going to get into political things, but I'm sure in 50 years, we're going to look back and say, I can't believe people did that in 2021. Like, it's crazy certain things that happen in the world. So you're right, meaning at the time, I'm sure there was that kind of go with the flow, do what everybody else is doing, and not that, you know, the way we look back at it, how could you do such a thing? So it definitely was some, I believe there definitely was some of that. Not to say that it's justified or whatever, but to say that there wasn't like an evil, malicious intent behind it. So when we think of Charleston, South Carolina, you know, remember that it's in the South. Remember that the neighbors of all of these people were also part of this cause. And therefore, what we're about to read, while it sounds somewhat jarring in terms of the Jewish support of the South, in some ways that was, you know, neither here nor there on the slavery issue, per se. However, many of the Jews did actually own slaves. Now, this wasn't like, it wasn't like every Jew had to own slaves, but I did see some interesting stories historically about, and this is somewhat humorous at the same time as being very, very sad, that the Jews trained their slaves how to make gefilte fish and cholent and stuff like that, which sounds crazy, but and has halachic issues. I don't know exactly. I wish there were responses about that. You know, that would be an interesting topic, but I couldn't find anything. But I did hear some of those legends. I did read up on some of those legends. So this is just a snippet from an article, just to set the scene as to what we're talking about. This is from the website of the Museum of the Jewish People in Beit HaTzfutot in Tel Aviv. And it says here, those adhering to the Sephardic Orthodox ritual seceded and in 1846 incorporated their own congregation, She'erit Yisrael, and with its own cemetery adjacent to that of KKBE. KKBE is Beth Elohim, as I said before. But separated from it by a brick wall. Okay, I'm not sure why that's important, but that's what they say. In 1854, an Ashkenazi congregation, Brit Shalom, now known as Brit Shalom Beth Israel, probably just the merger of two shuls, if I had to guess, was formed by Yiddish-speaking immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe who were uncomfortable both with the Sephardic ritual of She'erit Yisrael and the reform orientation of KKBE. Now, there's a lot packed into that sentence. I thought I had snipped more about the background here, but in 1824, the congregation of Beth Elohim has its own civil war. Now, this is not a civil war over slavery, this is a civil war over religiosity. Charleston, South Carolina is attributed with being the foundation, or the founding, I should say, the founding of Reform Judaism in America. And it happened at this 1824 meeting of, I think it was 44 families that signed on to basically say, we want to become more, whatever it is at that time, I don't know what they would call it at that time, more secular, you know, more, you know, sermons in English, prayers in English, an organ, a choir, right? More church-like, if you will. And there was apparently, you know, a schism between the president and the board. The board was traditional. The president was in favor of reforming. And there was apparently the standoff where the president didn't want to convene a board meeting because he knew the board would enact different constitutional laws and amendments to disbar reforming the shul. So he just never had a board meeting. It was like one of these standoffs. I don't know how long it took place, but it was a very humorous thing to read about. Like, yeah, I can see that happening, you know? But ultimately, They rewrite their laws. Ultimately, you know, push comes to shove, and the reformers win out. And Beth Elohim becomes basically a reform place. It still exists today. Yeah, Michael.
Until today, I always thought the reform started in 1840. So my question is not to count.
Well,
you said what happened in 1840.
So I'm not really well. So when I say reform, I don't necessarily mean like the literal institutional reform movement, but they were trying to reform things, reform rituals, reform, become more, you know, secular in their activities. Not necessarily to say that there was a reform movement that they, we want to become a reform shul. It wasn't like that yet. It was more like, let's change this, let's change that, where the traditionalists were like, no, we got to keep things the same. Yeah, David.
There was, as early as about 1810 in Germany.
Right.
Move toward, they may have even used the name reform.
There was
a certain Israel Jacobson in Germany, and so they weren't in Charleston just inventing.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
They weren't inventing them. They had, they were people. They
there was precedent for it. Yeah. In Europe, this was a much, you know, more significant movement at the time. Right, so either it's because the immigrants from there brought it over, or because there was a lack of religiosity in general in America, they also felt like, let's reform things. It's probably a mix of the two. I can't tell you for sure who and what, but there are long articles about it. You can see it in the old Jewish, the Hasmonean has a whole article I saw, and I'm sure the Historical Society has all these different articles about what exactly happened in those times. But that's a general overview of what's happening specifically in Charleston, South Carolina. And as you see here, the split, you know, everything comes to a head in 1846, where the traditionalists, right, the Sephardic Orthodox ritual, seceded in and created their own shul called Sheirit Yisrael. Sadly enough, I did a little research into Beth Elohim, this reform place that still exists today. I saw this past week they had a bat mitzvah in the shul. I listened to the girls' Dvar Torah to see, you know, what kind of stuff they're... And apparently the reform movement is on Shlach already. That's what they laned this past Shabbos. I don't know why. But she laned about the spies, and her whole Dvar Torah was about how, you know, the Torah is chauvinistic, and girls could have done that too. That was the whole Dvar Torah. It was fascinating. Like, the Dvar Torah was simply a rejection of what the Torah says. So it was a whole thing, and she went into all this, women's soccer versus men's soccer, the whole thing, like all the stuff you see on the news. It was basically just a news report. It was just shocking, just the things that they would talk about in shul. It was, I don't encourage anyone to see it, but if anybody wants some entertainment, you can look it up on the Beth Elohim website. It's still there. Obviously, they're live streaming everything and whatever. So that's Beth Elohim. It still exists today. It's still reform. And in 1854, an Ashkenazi congregation establishes itself. This is, again, still pre-Civil War, right? 1854, seven years before the literal Civil War. Obviously, there's tension and everything. But at the time, Brith Shalom was created by Yiddish-speaking immigrants who wanted their own thing. You can imagine, you know, Sephardis and Ashkenazis, especially immigrants coming over from Europe, very different things. And nowadays, everyone's sort of Americanized, and we have a Nesach Sfarad, and we can sort of get along. But back then, you literally were potentially different languages, right? So it's just incompatible in many ways. So, yeah, I mean, it depends on the immigrant, but yeah. So here you just see a little bit of the demographics. During the first decade of the 1800s, Charleston, with 500 Jews, had the largest, as well as the wealthiest and most cultured Jewish community in the USA. 500 Jews. Imagine that. That's a big community back then. In 1816, the Jewish population rose to over 600. It grew by 100 people in, I don't know how long that was. Depends when the first number is from. And that constituted approximately one-fifth of all Jews. 600 is one-fifth. That's not a lot. It's 3,000 Jews in all of America. In the following years, however, economic recession led to demographic decline. This, by the way, 1816 is right before they started that whole reform movement in Charleston. Members of the Jewish community were merchants, blacksmiths, journalists, teachers, seamstresses, and public servants. By 1830, 83% of the Jews owned slaves. That is a startling number. In Charleston, yeah. This is the South, right? 83% a rate comparable with that of the city's non-Jewish population, meaning they were just like everybody else, right? So at the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861, the Jews of Charleston joined the Confederate cause and members of the community fought in the Confederate Army. The defeat of the South left the city and its Jews decimated and impoverished. That is a very important line, because what we're about to read is a tshuva from the Netziv. The Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, in Europe, in Volozhin, is getting this question from Charleston. Now, there's one little detail which may or may not be very important in this discussion, which is whether he was actually speaking to Charleston. If you look at the first line of the tshuva, this, by the way, is Chelek Aleph, right? Chelek Aleph Simen Tes. So what does that mean? The Netziv has four different volumes of his tshuvas, and they get bigger and bigger as he gets older. This is one of the earliest tshuvas of the Netziv. The Netziv was born in 1817. So you can imagine he's right now, I don't know, 45, maybe 40, depending when he's getting this question. Probably earlier. Let's say 1861. Let's say it's 18. Well, I think they don't really join the Civil War in big numbers until 1862.
It was
45.
Minus
18. 62 minus 17 would be 45, right? Yeah. So he's about 45 years old. No, this is during the war. And if you look at the first phrase, so l'mahavai torasenu v'sochrei dvar Hashem uverosham ish nilvav harav v'chule. That v'chule was written by the Netziv. Right? Sometimes you have like these introductions to tshuvas where they give all these accolades to the rabbi, and the Netziv says, this great rabbi, etc. You know, he just like, he doesn't go, because it doesn't seem like he actually knows the person. That's what it sounds like to me. Be'ir charistan. Historians believe that it means Charleston. There is no place called Charistan, right? Historians believe this is referring to Charleston. And therefore, when we think of this tshuva, so keep in mind that it sounds as if he doesn't know what's going on. And therefore, he's almost playing off of the questioner, okay? So that's going to be important, because we don't know what the question was. He's going to quote it by reference, but he's not going to actually tell us the actual question. But you can see from the actual description of what, you know, by implication, you can see what was going on. So, keep in mind, Civil War, 1862, 1863, to Netziv, who doesn't know what's really going on, is going based on a description of the questioner from overseas, from America. Okay. Asher shalu mimeni ladas hachra b'tziruf katan l'dvarim shebikdusha. You want to know, can you use a child for a minyan? Now, pause number one. Why are we asking this question? Charleston, South Carolina, you just told me you had 600 Jews in 1816. This is 1862. You've got thousands of Jews. Why do you need a child? So historians believe that it's because the men went off to the Civil War. They say that 200 men, maybe more than that, went off to the Civil War just from Charleston to fight for the Confederate Army. Now, that's not a big number in the scheme of, you know, the Confederate Army. But for the Jewish community, you know, who's probably more secular than it is traditional, for a shul that's looking for a minyan, so 200 men can make a big difference. Obviously, not all 200 men went to the shul. But, you know, you're talking about 50 men that could make a minyan, and, you know, 40 of them went to fight the war.
200 men from
South Trump Charleston, yeah, that's what I read.
Jewish.
Yeah, yeah, from the Jewish community specifically. Sure. Charleston, like the whole city went.
No, yeah. That's what I'm saying. So, yeah. So the fact is that it's 200 in the population of 500 to 600.
Well, that was earlier. The number was from 1816. So I don't exactly in 1862. I don't know how many people were.
It said it grew to 600.
In 1816, that's what it said.
Oh,
so unclear exactly at what, you know, how many people are there at the time, but it's a lot of Jews to just pick up and leave. Okay, so this is an interesting point. If you look at my colleague's website, his name is Rabbi Scott Hoberman, just became the rabbi during COVID. I don't know how they pulled that off, but he interviewed and everything over Zoom, and he became the rabbi of a shul in Charleston, South Carolina, that was established in 1854, as we just read. This shul, Brith Shalom, he became the rabbi of that shul last summer. If you look at their website and their history, So it says in the description, I wanted to talk to him about it, but he didn't, you know, I couldn't get in touch with him. So it says in their website that they were the only shul during the Civil War to stay open. Meaning, and it says only one of three shuls, of the three shuls to stay open during the Civil War. What are the other two shuls? Beth Elohim, the Reform one, and Sherit Yisrael, the Sephardic one. So I don't know who's asking this question. What is interesting to see is maybe it's referring to the Netziv because he's Ashkenazic, or maybe this is Sherit Yisrael looking for a post like to answer the question. So I don't know if this is referring to Sherit Yisrael or Brit Shalom. I would assume it's not Beth Elohim asking the question. I don't know. I actually don't know. Maybe there weren't other rabbis that they could ask. Maybe they did ask. They somehow got to the table and then sit. And maybe that's... But you'll see from the questions, probably not. You'll see from the questions, probably not. So question number one is, we're running out of men. Can we use kids? Okay? That's the question. So it says in the Tziv, in answering... What?
We're assuming both boys.
Yes. Yeah. No one went that far yet. So Dvarim Shebekdusha Niflesi, I am in wonder about this. How could I take a stance on something which has already been, you know, discussed among the poskim? Man to Avid Hachi lo mishtabesh. Man to Avid Hachi lo mishtabesh. If you follow this, you follow that. You know, you have someone to rely on. This is actually very, you know, brought down in the poskim. You can see the Piskei Tshuvos, you know, he brings down this whole thing. Can a child do it? And he says there are different opinions, obviously. And he points out that the Mishnah Berurah says you shouldn't. And he says, Amnam ein lahatur lo haras chacham, that if these type of situations, you can never just, you know, based on, this is not one of those things you can base on the Mishnah Berurah. You have to go to a posik about it every time. Because the only time that you'd be allowed to do such a thing is under very, very extenuating circumstances. So this is what the Netziv is dealing with, a very extenuating circumstance, right? We're dealing with a potential loss of an entire shul if you don't allow it. Yeah, Michael.
When they ask the child, they mean above?
Presumably. Someone who can daven. Someone who can daven. That's what I would assume. But the Gemara, so the Netziv says, man daven lachi lo mishtabesh, man daven lachi lo mishtabesh.
I wonder if the Netziv, when he wrote this, you know, he may not have known how little knowledge there was.
It's hard to figure it out. But from his continuation, you'll see he knows some things, right?
I'm not talking about what the Netziv knew about the situation as much as, you know, we've talked about another shiurim, how uneducated the Jewish community in the United States was at the time.
Well, he's not only going to talk about kids. He's going to talk about irreligious Jews in a second also. So he does know some of it. So you'll see. Amnam says in the Tziv, Yotzer Tov Shelo Lahan Hig Tziv Katan Ach Yigdal. You should not include a child. You shouldn't include a child until he grows up and becomes a man. Ki imi nahagu kach ka'es shehu shasar chak. And this is part of the argument. Yiyah nishar kain afshi kisha yigdal. V'az lo yashasar chak. And then it's not going to be an extenuating circumstance. V'ein, I don't know what this means. Laman. He doesn't say. He doesn't explain exactly the situation. Right. In the halachic literature, that is critical. In terms of 9 and 1 versus, you know, 6 and 4 is a very big difference, obviously. He doesn't explain it explicitly, but it sounds like he's saying no for all of it. So I don't know if it's relevant for him. It's not worth it to allow Dvarim Shebekdusha. It's not worth including a child. What a beautiful line, but not as easy to put into practice. Just like you get schar for seeking out a minyan and being able to do it, you get schar for not having a minyan when you're not able to do it. Right, as we're saying, don't feel bad. Right, this is the Netziv, sort of the chizuk. Don't feel bad about not having a minion because you're doing the rest of Hashem by not having the minion. Right,
that's our COVID message from here.
Exactly, that's the exact same message I said last time. Kach yekablu schar al aprisha, which is a paraphrase from a Gemara, which is talking about making a drush on the word es. It's not really relevant to this discussion, but it's an interesting use of the phrase. So he's giving them chizuk. By the way, this Netziv is quoted. This Netziv is quoted in the general discussion. If you look in the Piskei Tshuvos footnotes, on the Shita, which says don't have a child included, it quotes this one. Right? It quotes the Tshuva about Charleston, South Carolina to determine whether or not. So I have a small ha'ara on that, which is it might be a different situation than a general situation. Meaning, just like this says, you always have to ask a posik for every situation. It might be a different situation for all things. You can't just quote this nitziv and say, oh, you can't use kids. Because who knows what kind of other situations would potentially allow it. And the nitziv, who knows something about the situation in Charleston, South Carolina, as we'll talk about in a second, might be a different situation. It might be a different topic or calculus. Why do I say that? Because remember, this is 1862, and the only 15 years beforehand, Beth Elohim became Reform. Right? They basically said, we're no longer going to be traditionals. We are now going to essentially become a Reform congregation. Now, with that backdrop, we don't know how much the Nitziv knows about the history. But with that backdrop, what we do know is that there was a looming threat over the Charleston, South Carolina community. That there were people who were trying to undo the traditional, you know, traditional ritual of Orthodoxy. In which case, there's a much greater risk for bending the rules, right? That's how I would, as a posek, consider the situation. Now, I don't know if that's what the Nitziv is considering also. But keep that in mind for the next paragraph. Because it seems like the questioner didn't only ask about children. He also asked about non-religious Jews. Then he says like this. I don't know what this is talking about. And this is the one thing that makes it a little questionable in terms of if it's talking about Charleston. Again, the historians believe it is talking about Charleston. But nonetheless, he says this, Lehistarif im hamechun m'shem Beis Yaakov. Now, I'm not sure if Beis Yaakov, he means to say Beth Elohim. But that's what he quotes it. That's what he calls it here. But it makes a lot of sense that it would be referring to Beth Elohim because listen to how he explains it. Right? They are publicly desecrating Shabbos. Now that is a halachic category of people. That's not just, you know, a description. There are certain things, especially for a minyan or a karban, that you cannot include people who are mechalel Shabbos before Hesya. That's a category of people, right? It's a descriptor. Feedback here, sorry. So,
and these are presumably people who started out from United.
Good, right?
Not talking about
perfect.
People who never knew.
Yeah, these are people. This is not like a third generation who's like just happens to be non-religious. These are the same people that broke off from the traditional or kicked out the traditionalists to create the Reform congregation. So we're talking about a very specific situation. So he says, "Leitzchaber imayim b'shum davar hashayach la'avodas Hashem v'yavakav nivur b'shulchan aruch avaryan v'chulei." What is he referring to? If you look at the Shulchan Aruch in Simen Nun Hay, so he says, so the Shulchan Aruch says, "Avaryan she'avar al gezeras hatzibor." If there is a sinner, literally a sinner who's doing something against the tzibor, o she'avar aver who's doing some specific sin, imlo niduhu nimne l'minin asar. If you haven't excommunicated him formally, so then you can still include him in a minyan. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. Even in Avaryan, right? You know, Afal Bishachata Yisraelhu, right? That's what the Gemara says. Even though you sin, you're still Jewish, you can still count for a minyan. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. As long as you didn't excommunicate him, meaning he hasn't crossed that threshold, so then you can still include him in a minyan. Yeah, Michael.
What kind of sin? I'm wondering if, like.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Breaking Shabbos properly versus eating that.
Yeah, he doesn't say explicitly.
Yeah, it's hard. That's probably another class.
Yeah, he doesn't say so explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch. Let me just take a quick look at the Mishnah Berurah. Because we davka avera she'avar l'te'avon, aval l'haches avil b'davar echad. Okay, good. This is what the Nesiv is about to say also. Meaning there are two types of sinners. There's the sinner that really likes chocolate cake, but the chocolate cake is not kosher. And then there's the sinner that hates God and wants to tell other people not to keep kosher, right? That's l'te'avon, because you have a desire for this thing or that thing, versus l'haches, you want to rebel against Judaism. You think that Judaism should be different, and we shouldn't follow this, and we shouldn't follow that. Not because you have some kind of desire that you just love that thing, but because you don't believe in the creed, etc., in general. So he says, "Oh, she'avar averet v'chulei nimnu l'min an asari." He's quoting Shulchan Aruch. "Aval zeh eino ela mumar l'davar echad." That's only someone who is opposed to one little thing. She'avah gav zeziv zeh kishrem toeva mikol makom erim mekam l'karbanos miposhe Yisrael. We would still accept karbanos from people who sin. K'deisu v'chulin uchadei she'yachzur b'tshuva. Right, the whole purpose is that maybe they're doing one thing wrong, and we'll still accept them so that hopefully they'll do tshuva and they'll come back. But that's a different ballgame. Someone who is believing in other gods. Now, that's not the case in South Carolina, but you know it's similar in throwing off the yoke of God, right? So, and someone who, what? And publicly, and someone who publicly desecrates Shabbos, she'ein mekabel mimenu karban mishum shemuchzak hu shelo yashavod. That person is not doing tshuva. That person believes in an entirely different outlook of the world. It's not like, oh, you know, he keeps this and keeps that, but he just can't get on, you know, he just loves hamburgers or cheeseburgers, right? That's not that, we're not talking about that type of person who we need to give chizuk to, that we need to encourage. We're talking about a person who doesn't believe in Torah and Shemayim, who doesn't believe in Mashiach, who doesn't believe in, you know, Olam Haba the same way. So, with that kind of person, muchzak hu shelo yashavot, v'im kein, gam tfilaso toeva. He quotes a Gemara in Brachos. I'm not sure what Gemara that is. So he says, this situation is very different. It's true, if you have an Avari and you have a specific person who is sinning in one way or another, so then yeah, you can try to bring him back, include him into a minyan. This happens to be a topic which is relevant to this week's parsha. Does anyone know why? What? Makosha Jetsim? No, that's an interesting one. What is this week's parsha all about?
Well,
the Meraglim. How many evil Meraglim were there?
Ten.
The Gemara Megillah learns out from a three-way Gezeirah Shava that's the source of a minion. It learns out from the Meraglim. Now, the Yerushalmi learns it out from the sons of Yaakov coming to Mitzrayim,
right,
which is also ten. It's a very different source. So Rav Moshe Feinstein points this out and says, according to the Bavli, it would seem like maybe we're choosing, now this is controversial because it could be for other reasons also, but maybe you're choosing the source of Meraglim as opposed to the Bnei Yaakov. Now you can say the Bnei Yaakov were also not the most pristine, at least according to the presentation of the Torah. But assuming that they were tzaddikim and they were justified one way or another, fine. But if you're going to learn from Bnei Yaakov, so you're talking about upstanding Jews. If you're going to learn it from the Meraglim, literally one of the worst group of people we have in our history.
Except that they started out.
That's the assumption according to the Midrash that Anashim, right, that they were people of stature of one way or one size or another. And then just interesting because I had this at my makom from Shabbos. We talked about on Shabbos about repeating words in davening. So three tshuvas before that, it talks about this again. Because somebody else says, how could you learn from the Meraglim? That means you can be more lenient about who you include in a minyan. That's just in terms of the number of people. It's a Gezeirah Shava. So the Rav Moshe points out that no, it's not true. It goes much deeper than Gezeirah Shava because the Gemara also asks, can you include a non-Jew? And he says, no, because the Meraglim are Jewish. So it says the Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's clear from the Gemara that they also thought that you can learn out the quality of the people, not just the quantity of the people, from the Meraglim. So it's a very interesting piece here in Rav Moshe. He talks about it. Gam aladin tesar chasar lomer davar shav kedusha. Gam ken yafin mi also akra atzmonami hu af ke echos hamaraglim. They have to be at least as good as the Meraglim, which means that they have to be at least Jewish. Jewish, but not people that, you know, people, and even people that are willing to go against Eretz Yisrael, go against, you know, what Hashem said. Right, Eda, right. That's the word Eda is the word that the Gemara and Megillah uses. So the Meraglim v'yicholim lomar kaddish gedusha v'rak malas tefila b'tzibur leka. That's a very interesting phrase. We oftentimes get mixed up. I was at a wedding yesterday, and this came up also. There's a difference between being able to respond to kaddish and kedusha and davening with a minyan. Right, being able to respond to kaddish and kedusha requires 10 religious men, or 10 Jewish men, I should say, per this discussion. But to be considered tefillah b'tzibur, you have to be davening with 10 upstanding religious men who haven't yet davened yet, right? So, for instance, you know, when we have, you know, the chaste YIOP who daven at the early minyan but stick around for a few extra minutes to make sure that the 7 o'clock has a minyan for those first couple kaddishim. So that is allowing us to say kaddish. But if that were the same group for Shmona Esrei, it wouldn't be a lechachila, because you're supposed to have 10 men who haven't davened yet davening together. That's called tzvila b'tzibor. You were all davening as a congregation. But we can still daven and then say Kaddish and Kedusha with those 10 people, right? So that's the difference. So Rav Moshe makes the same distinction with irreligious Jews. They would make you allowed, they would allow you to say Devarim Shebekdusha, you can say Kaddish and Kedusha, but you wouldn't fulfill Tefillah B'Tzibor with them, because they wouldn't be davening in the same way, right? You have someone who's Mechal Shabbos, so then you wouldn't necessarily say, well, that guy's davening is the same as my davening, because he doesn't believe in davening, right? He doesn't believe in the same God that I believe in. Yes, Steve.
So it is the ultimate problem, because you're going to be saying the Chazor Sashatz and saying Hashem's name extra.
There's no problem. That's why you'd be allowed to do it.
No,
according to your emotion.
But in essence, so let's say we say, okay, we're going to have a minyan with 10th person is a kid, or the 10th person is a non-Jew. We would have davened by ourselves anyway. We davened now is a minyan. So minyan, not minyan. If it
you wouldn't be able to do it because there are shots with a kid or with a non-Jew potentially.
Well, you wouldn't be able to do it because of the repetition of the right.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to say those things.
Saying them without the minyan would be saying Hashem's name in vain.
Well, partly Shane says saying Hashem's name in vain, or because there's an independent halacha that you can't say those things without a minyan.
So that's exactly what it comes to. It's not, if it's the things that you can say anyway, and whether it counts as a minyan, or it counts as a kaddish, or it counts as a minyan,
yeah.
What's the problem of saying them if you don't have a minyan? Is because you should.
You're not supposed to say them. Yeah. Yeah, you're not supposed to say them without 10 religious Jews.
People are conservative around.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the funny part about this discussion, which is you can only do this b'shas harchak. Well, when else would you need to include a conservative or non-religious person in your minyan, unless it was a b'shas harchak? I mean, let's say you have 50 people in your minyan and a conservative guy walks in, like, he can stand there, we're not going to count him as part of the minyan, but like, that's not a b'shas harchak that we have to ask the question even.
No, but then the
okay, but those are separate issues. Those are separate issues that you have to talk about.
That would be, so we're saying, we're making an exception here. Don't carry the exception to anything else.
Maybe. You'd have to look into that independently. Right. So the Netziv continues, and I'm not really sure, this is one of those parts of the tshuva, I'm not really sure, it would really depend on what the person asked to understand why he's going into this part. But he says, V'hinei ksiv v'mishlei aleph l'inin orve l'dam adam b'ni al teilech b'derech itam mina raglech min sivasam. Right? Don't walk in their ways and prevent your legs from their paths. Right? A lot of those in the Monday Night Mishlei class will know that this is a refrain that Shlomo Melech uses a lot. The word derech versus the word nativ. Derech means a general way, general direction, and nativ means a specific path, more detail. So Perish says in the Nativ, derech hu hakevusha l'rabim. Derech is a general place like a highway. Nesiva hu derech hayachid. But a path is a specific, detailed, way to go. V'hizir akasav asher b'derech harabim. When you're on Derech Harabim, the general, even though you can't get around without going on that highway, the general path, you shouldn't go specifically with them. I don't know exactly if that's a reference to some other phrase, but it sounds like, you know, hand in hand. When it comes to the specific path, if it's their specific way of doing things, so get away from it. Similar to those people who are trying to change Judaism and to destroy it and to remove it from the chayah, the ways of Olam Haba. Asher b'derech harabim haynu b'mischar. Maybe when it comes to dealing with them in general, b'derech harabim, that means to go to their store, right, to buy produce from them, whatever. B'mischar, business. V'chadoma i'av shalom no b'mischaram. You can't just not buy things. However, you should not have any specific or individual personal partnership with them. Okay, not really exactly sure of the context there. But kol zeh b'derech hamischar shu derech harabim. That's only when it comes to general things you can associate with them in general, you know, world, you know, day to day type of interactions. Aval b'nesiv hamiyuchares shalahem. But in their specific way of doing things, haynu based tefila shalahem, their specific sanctuaries, their davening, uchadoma minar aglecha mamish ki af kirusa mamshich halev, af kirusa mamshich halev. I'm not sure if that's the same word as apikores. It sounds like it, but it essentially means, you know, the wantonness or that general do whatever you want feeling is mamshich halev, right? That can really be seductive. Yeah, that's where the word comes from. I think same thing. V'im ki ein lihitkotet imahem, even though, you know, you shouldn't, you know, fight with them specifically. V'chmo dechsiv atis chaber mireim aval yesh lizar harbe shloi kasha b'chabratam. Okay, and he talks about it in his drushas in the Hemek Davar. So that's the Netziv. That's the Netziv. That is presumably referring to Charleston, South Carolina. And I just brought this last source here to show you about one of the historians' beliefs that this is referring to Charleston. This is a book that was written in 1902. So, I mean, it's very possible that he's more intimately aware of the situation than, you know, a historian nowadays. This is Elzas Barnetta, or Barnett. Maybe A is a middle name. Sorry about the copy and paste here. For whatever reason, it wouldn't copy and paste regularly. It was a PDF, and it's an old book. And it goes through a little bit of the history of the Charleston, South Carolina community. And then, this is going to be very hard for me to show you, but the breaking out of this is like a few lines up from, four lines up from the bottom of the first paragraph, if you could call it that. The breaking out of the war and the removal from the city of many of its members, however, put an end to its prosperity and caused the synagogue to close its doors. I think it's referring to Sherit Yisrael. Neither congregation was now able to stand alone, and the way was thus paved for reconciliation and amalgamation. Of this we shall tell in a later chapter, right? This whole book. But after this happens and the shul basically closes, everyone goes back to Beth Elohim and they all become Reform. Now, the others, the traditionalists, might have gone over to Brith Shalom, which was the only one to stay open according to their website during the Civil War. But this is the unfortunate circumstance that the Netziv was trying to avoid but ultimately caused. If you would say that. You know, it's hard to say what would have happened otherwise. But he tells them not to include a child. He tells them not to include a near religious Jew. And ultimately, everybody has to go over there. Now, unclear, obviously, if the people were real traditionalists, so they might not have given in. They might have made their own house meeting for a while. They might have gone to Brit Shalom. Again, unclear exactly what the rest of history is. But this is a footnote on that piece. There's an interesting reference in literature that probably belongs to this period. Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv, the chief of rabbinical school of Elazhin, was consulted by Charleston rabbi as to whether minors or Sabbath breakers may be included in the making of a minyan, religious quorum of 10 men. His answer, rather unfavorable to both, is to be found in his volume, as we just saw, the first chelek, number 9. So whether we can learn from this netziv is really my question that I come away with, because it's unclear to what extent the netziv knew about the situation in South Carolina. Meaning, it sounds like he definitely knows that there's a Reform movement. The Netziv himself was very, unfortunately, acquainted with the Haskalah movement, right, that's going on in Europe. So maybe he's associating the two, and maybe that was unwarranted or unjustified. But it's possible that he knows specifically about this community and how it was itself, you know, breaking up because over this issue itself.
It would be interesting to know exactly how the question
is. Right. I would love to see the actual question. It's hard to understand what the question was. if he's speaking in generalities, so then we can learn from this and see for all their situations. Happens to be the other post can disagree. We saw Rav Moshe and we saw the Shulchan Aruch and things like that. But it's unclear if he's specifically talking to Charleston because he knows what's going on in Charleston, or he's speaking in general about these halachos.
Where does it matter?
Why does it matter?
What would the
nafkamina would be nowadays when you have Tinok Shenishbaz, right? People that grew up in the Reform movement. People that grew up not religious. People saw the Pew study maybe from a few weeks ago, how irreligious conservative and Reform Jews are becoming, right? The numbers in conservative and Reform are just shrinking generation by generation, and the Orthodox one is getting bigger. I don't know if people saw this. The Pew study. If people saw this, this one chart, it breaks down the different decades of ages. Well, there was one 8 years ago, and there was one that came out 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So, but if you look at what's fascinating is if you look at the decades of ages, the 20-year-olds, the 30-year-olds, and the 40-year-olds. If you look at it, the numbers are bigger than that. You know, it's like 40 to 65. But the 18 to 29 is a very important one, obviously, for the future of every community. So the 18 to 29, I believe it said 17% Orthodox. And then the other ones were like 20, I think conservative was small, and then Reform was like 22 or something like that. And the one right after that, the 30-year-olds, was like, you know, even it was 11% Orthodox, and the Reform was like 29%. So you can see the trend is that the next decade, the Orthodox community will be the biggest. Now, that's mostly because the vast majority is unaffiliated. Right? You know, that part is growing bigger and bigger, and they're taking off from the conservative and Reform parts. So ultimately, you're just getting a bigger and bigger piece of the non-religious entirely, or the unaffiliated. And that will ultimately, you know, shrink because they'll just leave completely. They won't even associate it as being Jewish. But more and more of the conservative and Reform is being, you know, taking bigger pieces out of it to create the unaffiliated, and the Orthodox will just become a bigger and bigger proportion.
And that's not even kind of the fact that a good proportion of Reform Jews are people who we wouldn't even consider Jewish.
Right, yeah, that's true. Right, that's also according to their definition of Jewishness.
One thing that I don't know that's been looked at is I definitely think there's a lot of traditionalists in the conservative movement who gave up and became Orthodox.
Yeah, there are definitely some. Many of the common or conservative movement folk probably went to the other direction.
That's yeah. The bigger trend.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the bigger, that's why right. Conservative Judaism is
yeah, yeah, yeah. Terrible. Yeah, no, so they're getting squeezed out. But either way, so the reason that it's important is because when it comes to this generation, so do we look at this Netziv and say, okay, you know, we can't include them in a minyan? Or do we look at Rav Moshe and say, well, maybe it's a different time, and it's a different place, a different situation. Over there in Charleston, so you're dealing with mamash a civil war in the middle of the community, you can't give in, you can't budge an inch, right? But nowadays, where it's, you know, bygones be bygones, no one's threatening the Orthodox community like they were back then. And these unaffiliated Jews aren't trying to, you know, to usurp the Jewish community in one way or another. So then are we really concerned that...
You have a different issue as well right now. The fact is, when there's an Orthodox community, and you worry about not having a minyan, we only have nine, and what about this one guy?
Yeah.
There's 45 other minyan around, which exist in Charleston.
In Detroit, yeah.
But I'm saying, like... The concern here is if they disband this minion,
right.
It's not like the nine can go elsewhere.
Right, right.
Over here, it's much easier to say sorry. You know, every
right.
week. You
right,
have
I hear that. That's a counter argument.
So stop
right,
meaning.
I hear the counter argument. I hear the counter argument.
See, Steve, I was thinking the exact opposite. Something yeah. Very different. The tenth guy comes in.
Yeah.
How can he be a non-believer? He's in shul.
He's coming
to
shul. Yeah.
Of course he's a believer, otherwise he wouldn't show up.
Right, there could be...
And to say, oh, we're not going to count you, he's going to say, you Orthodox people are insane. I'm a Jew just like you.
Right.
And
well, this is...
And never have anything
right.
to do
well,
with
this is the part. This is the part where it gets a little interesting in terms of our day versus the Netziv's day. The Netziv's day, as he said that phrase, Muchzak Shehu Lo Yashuv. We know for sure they're not going to do tshuva. But that's because they're the rallying cry to not be Orthodox. Nowadays, a guy comes off the street into an Orthodox shul, he's not the hoorah, let's go become Reform guy. It's not muchzak. It's not for sure that he's not going to do tshuva. Maybe he's looking for more. Maybe he's just unaware. He's oblivious, or maybe he's ignorant of what it means to be Orthodox Jew. So I would say most unaffiliated Jews are much more like that, you know, than back in the times of the Netziv, where if you were non-Orthodox, what it meant was you were choosing to do something else. Right? So it's a balancing act. But I hear your point, which is you're ruining a shul, and that's what happens. If we would tell the Netziv, you know, Rav Berlin, you know that this shul will close and those Orthodox members will have to go join a Reform shul. If you don't let them have a kid in their minion, he might say something else. You might be right. I don't know. Well, he doesn't know that that's going to happen. He also doesn't know that the Confederates are going to lose so badly that they're not going to have anyone coming back from the war. Maybe he assumed, well, when they come back from war, it'll be okay. But the community was destroyed. I mean, the people didn't come back.
You know, the other difference that I think we sometimes forget about is in those days, you know, nowadays, if you call up a Kosek and you ask a question, the Kosek has the ability to ask you and get more information about it.
Right, right. Like here, he's got one letter.
Send a letter to the Netziv, it takes probably 6 months to get there.
And you have to, you hope you put all the details that he would want to know in it. Yeah,
and
it's hard.
Know, he's not going to write right. back and say, yes, I that's need more information.
Yeah, that's part of the issue. We don't know how much he knew. Well, it was 4 years, but yeah. Michael?
Yeah, but I don't know what the mail service was.
Yeah, right. If it was anything like today, it definitely didn't get there in time.
This is the funniest part. Is there an example where they have a different situation and make the determination that this, in this situation, in this place, they can't?
Yeah, I don't know. It sounds like that from the Shulchan Aruch.
There might be one, or there could be one in the future. In
yeah.
The right,
that's what the postkim sounds like. It sounds like there is. I don't know. I'm not as much of an expert to know that. Maybe before July 4th. We'll see. All right. Shkoyach again to the Pollux. Thank you for sponsoring. Le'ilo Nishmas. Esther, Leah Esther.
Bas
Avram, Mirza Hashem, our learning. Anyone else who listens to this recording is learning should be Le'ilo Nishmas. Everyone should have a wonderful holiday. Enjoy.